the face of things to come. Oh, your constitution, well, my friend, it's gonna have to bend. I'm here to tell you about destruction of all the evil it will have to end.
Well, thank you, thank you, thank you. That was Nina Simone. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Monday, September the 17th, day 7 of a strike by 30,000 school teachers and support personnel in the city of Chicago. It's down to the wire now, but a move this morning by the city has only upped the ante on bringing the strike to an end. Stacey Davis Gates is a legislative and political director for the Chicago Teachers Union and a member of the union's big bargaining team. Stacey, thanks for being with us once again to bring us an update. Are you with us?
Hello?
Stacey?
Yes, I'm here. Hi.
Okay, great. I was saying that thanks for being with us to give us this update. Mayor Rahm Emanuel went to court today seeking an order to force an end to the strike, which he said in court papers is a threat to the safety of the district's 400,000 school children and a clear and present danger not just to them but to all Chicagoans. How is his action being seen by the union? Is it a major hiccup in the bargaining process?
Well, first off, the Cook County Circuit Court judge did not agree to hold a hearing on the matter today. He said that there's a possibility for setting a hearing for Wednesday, but he questioned if the issues would be moot if the strike is over by then. So the judge did not immediately fall in line, basically, with this. As far as we're concerned, it's just another very clear indication of the type of or the lack of leadership he's demonstrated in this negotiation from the very beginning. You know, we've talked about it here in the office. I mean, Stand for Children came before the mayor was even inaugurated as our chief executive here in Chicago. And the bill, Senate Bill 7 that they passed, clearly encumbered our right to strike by making us have a 75% strike authorization vote before it could even happen. Well, we surpassed that. 90% of our members voted, and 98% of them said yes. So to the extent that he never really intended to bargain with us, that he intended to implement his plan without collaboration, without consensus, it's kind of very clear right now. I mean, we're used to this. You know, I think we thought that he probably would have done this last week. It's just another attempt to try to encumber democracy and to bully us back into a building that we've clearly said needs some help.
The union, meanwhile, is seeking rank-and-file approval of a tentative agreement that was hammered out over the weekend. Where does that stand?
You know, here's the thing. Back to that 75%, the byproduct of getting 20-plus thousand people, almost 30,000 people, to weigh in on a contract means that people need to be engaged. And so it's not that easy. So the byproduct of this strike authorization vote is that our full membership is fully engaged in this. There's not one member who doesn't understand the stakes. There's not one member who's willing to cede their, you know, particular authority. Our motto at CTU is to empower our rank and file to lead our leadership. And so to take them, you know, a document and not be clear about what they want and how they feel would be counter to everything we've done up until this point. And that would just be offensive and disrespectful to the process that we've built here and to what we're fighting for, what we're struggling for, each of us.
Well, what in the tentative document that you have hammered out over the weekend, the union that is, what are those, how is the concern, or how are the concerns of the membership reflected in that document?
Well, I think some concerns came, well, here's the thing, we know that anywhere from 100 to 200 schools are going to be closed in Chicago if the city gets its way. We know that. That provides a tremendous amount of apprehension for our membership, right? Then added to that is that you have no trust. The trust between the two entities is next to nothing. Is absolutely next to nothing. So teachers who are, again, invested in this process want to be sure that they're getting something that they struggled for. Clearly they understand that everything that they want will not be included in this contract. They get that. They also get that the issues on justice don't necessarily always reside in a collective bargaining agreement. They reside in more struggle to, you know, provide the schools that Chicago children deserve. Some of it being legislative, some of it being more social, some of it being organizing even more of our communities. So they get that. They just want to make sure. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. You go ahead.
They just really and truly want to round this particular process out and segue into the next battle.
All right, so let's talk nuts and bolts. We're talking now the tentative agreement, at least from the union side, involves a three-year contract with an option for a fourth year. Tell me about, you know, let's deal with the question of pay raises. How does it look right now in the document as will be presented to the membership tomorrow?
Well, what we understand is that we've actually been able to negotiate the length of day. We have a 7-hour day for our elementary teachers, a 7-hour and 15-minute day for our high school teachers. Over 600 additional positions were added, overwhelmingly in art, music, and physical education. We have proposed additional social workers and nurses. Hopefully that is something that the board will take. They're still working that one out. We've also proposed, and we're still working this one out, to add parents to the class size committee to make sure so they get to be a part of this process in a more institutional manner. Again, the 3-year agreement, not a 4-year agreement. We're very clear that we're in a recession right now, and to make an agreement with such a long number of years attached to it would not be fair to for our members. We're also, with the evaluation procedures, we've added some checks and balances to try and make a very unreasonable, unfair evaluation as fair as we could possibly get it. And so those are just some of the things, and I've told you before, books on the first day of school, making sure that our clinicians, our social workers, our speech pathologists, our counselors have private meeting space, making sure that they have locked a cabinet so they can, you know, the files that they maintain are not, you know, open for perusal but locked up. So these are some, you know, some of the things that are huge. We've protected the class size language that we have now, which is still large, you know, by no stretch of the imagination, but the board wanted to remove all reference to class size caps from the collective bargaining agreement. So we were able to maintain that language. So, you know, it's not perfect. You know, it's not perfect, but, you know, a lot of it was, you know, won through struggle. And the struggle continues. This is, I think our members are clear. This is one of the first things that has united us as, you know, a union, every rank and file member. And now we are continuing, you know, the struggle for justice, because at the end of this contract, we still have 160 schools in Chicago that do not have libraries. We still have schools that do not have proper heating and air conditioning. So these are things that persist. at this point, and our members are not going to back down.
How does the mayor's action, this is basically going to court, does it signify or does it suggest a sense of frustration that maybe the city in the latter day days of labor negotiation has had to backtrack on several key points that it was pressing? And if so, what are those points?
Well, merit pay was huge. They wanted to implement merit pay. The neoliberal, like, education reform agenda, at the top of that is merit pay. And so they wanted to eradicate completely the way that we've been being paid. You get paid based on experience, and you get paid based on the type of refinement you do to your own particular education. And both of those things have been seen through research to be an effective means of promoting student achievement. And he wanted to get rid of that completely. Well, we're not dealing with merit pay at all here in Chicago. So that has been, that's a critical win. That is a very critical win. In most other large urban districts, merit pay in some way, shape, or form has been forced upon the teachers, not here in Chicago.
It is said that if the rank and file approves of the contract, and if in fact the city does also approve of the contract, it would be an addition of $74 million or so to the city's budget. Is this in a way going to be used by the city to illustrate why it is necessary to bring unions in line, because they actually are costing cities, municipalities all across the country much too much money?
I think what we've done is raise the stakes on priority. Our contract fight was more of a holistic contract fight in that we brought attention to what our students deserve and what our schools are lacking. So then the argument is now about the priorities of a city. Now, a city, a world-class city such as Chicago, that can launch the first African-American man into the White House, certainly that same city can figure out how to offer a world-class education to its students. We held a NATO conference here. Well, everyone knows we held NATO here. And we were able to offer the heads of state a very wonderful visit, meeting space, everything. That's the same sort of priority we should have for our students. You know, when people said that there wasn't any money to have this, somehow miraculously the money came. They were able to plug the hole, fill in the gap. Why do we have the opposite discussion when it comes to maintaining public services for our citizens in these cities? It just seems like a very wrong-headed discussion that we continue to have. So
let's talk a bit about the logistics now. So
sure.
What happens tomorrow? What is the membership expected to do? And where do things go from there, the timeline?
Well, today I visited some pickets myself, and, you know, I saw our members in circles with one another, going over language and asking questions and having some debate and, you know, parsing out the details a bit. And I think that what's going to happen on Tuesday evening is that our members are going to come. They're going to have a robust discussion about this. They're going to be still invigorated, and we're going to leave there understanding what we want, understanding where the struggle continues, and we're going to move on just as strong, stronger and more unified. I honestly believe that on Tuesday, you know, our members will have, you know, had the opportunity to, you know, review everything. I will say that I'm excited for Tuesday. Yesterday we had a meeting. The discussion was robust. The support for our leadership is as strong as ever, and I really and truly think that Tuesday will bring about very similar discussions, and we'll conclude something.
Well, thank you so much, Stacey Davis Gates, for joining us today and bringing us up to snuff. You've been a fantastic resource in getting us to understand what's going on with the Chicago Teachers Union strike. Thank you so much for being with us today.
And thank you for the opportunity. We appreciate it.
Same here. Well, let me get back some striking parallels right after this. Yeah. Huh?
Some folks are gonna get the notion, I know. They'll say I'm preaching hate. If I have to swim the ocean, well, I will. Just to communicate.
All right. The great Nina Simone, from her appearance in Harlem, I believe that was 1969, with Revolution. It was a kind of an anthem back then. There are several parallels between the teachers' strike in Chicago and the 2005 transit workers' strike in New York City that shut down its bus and subway systems for 3 days that year, leading into the Christmas season. Like the Chicago teachers' strike, the New York City transit strike was the first in 25 years. The one previous to that was in 1980. Both strikes were born out of rank-and-file reform movements within their respective unions, and both strikes are of national significance. Roger Toussaint was the president of the Transport Workers Union Local 100 in New York City and leader of the 2005 transit strike. He joins us now to talk about parallels between and the lessons to be learned from the Chicago teachers' strike and the New York City transit strike. Roger, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Tris, and hello to all of the listeners.
Well, I'm so delighted to have you with us because I know that you have a particular take. I know you've been following the strike, and I wanted to start off by asking you, what parallels do you see? What is resonating with you as a former head of the TWU's Local 100 as you observe the Chicago teachers' strike?
Well, I was just listening to the tail end of the report by the sister. And she actually hit all of the points on the head with respect to what is important for people to bear in mind. For instance, the last question regarding who gets blamed for the additional cost. And she correctly points out that how the conversation changes from when it is a matter of finding money to do things compared to finding money for the public good, for public education, or for transit, and so on, the entire conversation shifts, and we shouldn't accept that. I just wanted to clarify, and I don't know if she's still on the line. On Tuesday, I believe, tomorrow, that the Chicago Teachers Union House of Delegates that will be voting on whether to go back to work,
right,
to recommend the contract to the members. So it's not a membership vote, but I think that they have an 800-member House of Delegates, which is a very sizable group that will make that decision. But what came to mind as I listened as well is the news about Rahm Emanuel threatening to get an injunction and put that on the table right alongside the report about a vote taking place tomorrow. And this is exactly the wrong thing to do. It does not help the situation. Normally, when you have a tentative agreement, you don't undertake any action that could undermine either side following through on the agreement. That begins to be in bad faith. But it's bullying that's typical of Rahm Emanuel and characteristic of the Republican demeanor. And we had some similar experience in New York City when Bloomberg, Mayor Bloomberg, resorted to calling all leaders thugs or thuggish in the middle of that 2005 strike. And that didn't help either. The other thing that strikes me is that it's important for folks to understand how to evaluate settlements and agreements made on the battlefield, such as what we're watching in Chicago. I think that the appropriate measure is whether there was a significant change or improvement from what was on the table before, and whether the proposed settlement addresses the issues that the teacher struck over, which appears that on both scores that that the answer would be yes. In fact, they got certain demands removed from the table, such as the merit pay issue, which is critical, as was just explained to us. And they apply the brakes. I think from what I've seen, and of course the devil is in the details, but from what I've seen, from what I've heard, the various provision on hiring additional teachers, on adding quality education, art, music, physical education, world languages, and other special subjects, and so forth, could be seen as ways to apply the brakes from going in the complete opposite direction of peer reliance on standardized tests in teacher evaluation and holding teachers up to student performance while underfunding the schools and underfunding education and putting a blind eye to children going to school poor and homeless and without textbooks and so on and so forth. So in those respects, I think those are the appropriate measures, and it sounds like I want to congratulate the teachers in teachers' union for the type of progress that they have made standing up and fighting back. And I think that is the big drama on the national scene is whether it is appropriate and correct to stand up and fight back, and whether there is any power in doing that versus either go along, get along, and simply doing concessionary negotiation. And I think that there's a parallel between the 2005 transit strike and the teachers' strike for the idea, for the notion of standing up and fighting back, that is still the age-old way to achieve progress and to make change and to defend
I want to address that a little bit, or bring you a little bit closer, because I see that as an interesting parallel that with the Chicago Teachers Union, this essentially is an inside effort to an upsurge, if you will, a rank-and-file upsurge against business as usual with the union and business as usual at City Hall. I see that as a stunning parallel with what you experienced with the transit strike.
Well, certainly, but just to finish the thought, on the other hand, in terms of evaluating the settlement that's on the table, the tentative agreement, is also not appropriate to measure it against whether it magically solved the problem in the country, on the entire front of education, and did it bring Rahm Emanuel to his needs. That's important because there are going to be voices out there trying to promote exaggerated expectations and hold these heroic teachers up to standards that are unreasonable. And you don't play with strikes as a general proposition from a worker standpoint. The bigger the strike, the higher the stakes, and the shorter the strike, the better, precisely because the stakes are higher. And settlements that you make in those battles, those type of national spotlight, critical battles that could make or break an entire labor movement, will always look different than some settlement achieved, you know, across the bargaining table. But to get back to your point about what's going on behind the scenes in terms of which way forward for the labor movement and for social justice causes, do you go along, get along, do you stand up business? Chicago is a very interesting, what has happened there with the Chicago Teachers Union and the Caucus for Rank and File Education, it's a replication in many respects of a lot of the drama, a lot of the unfolding issues, tension that was going on in New York. I don't know whether your listeners are fully aware, but the incumbent officers in the Chicago Teachers Union were voted out just only 2 years ago. And in that sense, they're in a more difficult position than we were in New York, because they've only had 2 years to consolidate themselves, consolidate their rank and file movement, and to prepare for these negotiations. Because the other side has been preparing. Rahm Emanuel got elected the year after 2011. And after that, there was educational reform pushed through the legislature in Chicago that weakened collective bargaining and weakened seniority and job security, and in fact changed the requirements for teachers to authorize strike to make it a vote by 3/4 of the membership. So in some respects, the other side picked this fight by passing this legislature and beating the drum for crushing the teachers and for just railroading the whole collective bargaining process and steamrolling over people. So the teachers answered the call, and we owe them, I think the nation and all progressive people owe them a huge debt of gratitude. Now, what was taking place, from what I understand, the incumbent officers prior to this change in the teachers' union, one of the things I understand that they were saying was that if there was this change in the teachers' union, such as what did end up occurring, that it would transfer the power of the teachers' union over to the community and to the parents. And it's very interesting that they would say that, because it's a window into a decades-long problem on that front, the relationship or relative alienation, to the extent it exists, between organized labor or teachers' unions and the surrounding communities. That has been a problem right all across the country. But to their credit, the Chicago Teachers Union stood for more aggressive representation of their members, for more aggressive defense of teachers and of public education, and for deeper partnerships with the communities. And that has been so on the one hand, you have Rahm Emanuel and the state legislature setting up this confrontation and trying to steamroll over the teachers. On the other hand, you have a change taking place on the ground among the teachers that is a real rank and file movement, not a movement from above, and that attempts to ground itself first and foremost among the teachers themselves, but connected closely to the communities and the parents and the students.
Well, in a way, Roger, you're telling your story of the TWU. I mean, here was a traditionally Irish-led union taken over by black leadership, originating, as anybody can tell, from the Caribbean a few years before. How did the business as usual model of the TWU react to this particular dynamic?
Well, they reacted almost violently. I mean, just to fast forward, in the 2005 transit strike, one of the problems that we had was that our international union issued a statement ordering transit workers to cross the picket line and return to work. It was completely unheard of for another labor for an international union to do. So we were facing a push to strike break from within our own union, and that was from the old guard within the union, and that was 5 years after we had taken over Transport Workers Union Local 100 in New York City. They were still bitter and angry and trying to see a restoration of the old guard in the Transport Workers Union. But in 2001, when we took over the union, one of the things that we made a major emphasis was reestablishing the ownership of the union by the rank and file members through a series of programs of education and democratization of the union, and stripping away privilege from union leaders that had become accustomed to not only extremely high salaries, but all sorts of golden parachutes that they surround themselves with and do very little work, which is still, unfortunately, extremely, extremely typical today. But a program that also established multiple ways for the members to reconnect with the union. We established training and upgrade fund programs for advancement, child care funds, and eventually paid maternity leave. We have over 6,000 women in the subway system, bus system in New York City who are being disadvantaged as a result of the absence of child care. And then we also began celebrating all of the things that were important to our members. We began annual events for our women members, for retirees. We began for the first time to hold various ethnic pride celebrations of African Americans, West Indians, Hispanic, Russians, Indians, Italians for the first time, consistently for veterans and so forth. So we worked for years to establish any number of ways for members to reconnect with the organization and develop a renewed sense of ownership of the organization. Because at the end of the day, democracy within a union is about the extent to which people are participating in the union. People are participating, then eventually you straighten problems out because of the participation. So there was that went on. We did that for a number of years. Unfortunately, there have been a number of setbacks in that regard in the last couple of years. But ours was born out of a genuine, real rank-and-file movement as well that reached a crescendo at the end of 2000, leading to a change in the union in January 2001, and eventually the New York City subway strike in December of 2005.
What would you say the setbacks have been based on what you know of the union? I know you follow what's happening within the Transit Workers Union and your beloved Local 100. What would you say the setbacks have been with respect to the initiatives that you had undertaken and that the rank and file basically staging this upsurge of power within the union? How was that in fact maintained? Does it still exist?
Well, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And the number one issue that we struck over was over the attempt to impose a more onerous pension on new transit workers, new hires. So that's why some people remember our strikers saying that we refused to give up the unborn transit worker, meaning our children coming behind us, our nephews and nieces and the children of our neighbors who would be driving the buses, driving the trains, selling tickets on the subway and cleaning the subway and bus system. That's from our community. So we felt it was real important to, when they attempted to move the pension from a 2% contribution to triple it to a 6% contribution, Well, we effectively and completely stopped that in the 2005 transit strike, and in fact brought the labor movement in New York City a reprieve from the imposition of a new Tier 6 pension, which is, has been a priority of the establishment for a number of years. Well, lo and behold, this past April 2012, a Tier 6 pension exactly of the same dimension that was that they attempted to impose on us became the law of the land in New York State, almost literally without a shot being fired, either by the current leadership of my union, Local 100 Transport Workers Union, or by much of the leadership of the labor movement in New York City, unfortunately. So that's an example of one huge setback. The other thing is that the subway workers and bus workers in New York are now working without a contract, with no plan in sight or no resolution path in sight, which is one of the legacies in New York City. It's almost legend in New York City, that transit workers remained about the only workforce out there that you actually had to have a resolution of their contract in a timely manner compared to all the other groups of city and state workers. That was the legacy handed down to us that we maintained and kept and remained proud of, and that has now been given up. Those are just two examples, but there have been numerous setbacks, and there has been a general ungluing of the membership connection to the organization as the current labor leaders up there inside of the union are more concerned about their own careers and their own reputations and so forth, and less concerned about membership participation in the life of the organization. So they have conceded the apprenticeship program that we put in place for entry-level members who generally tend to be more from people of color and women. They allowed those programs to, in large part, collapse. A lot of non-enforcement of provisions that we had put in place that were carefully designed and crafted to spur and encourage and grow membership participation in the organization. A lot of that stuff has fallen to the wayside, as some examples.
I want to also discuss another stunning example of parallels between the Chicago teachers' strike and the New York City transit workers' strike. And that is, in fact, politics. Here we have two historically heavily Democratic cities. And yet, we have, in fact, members of the Chicago Teachers Union, the CTU, have said on this program, in fact, this was Stacy's direct quote, that Rahm Emanuel is a Democrat nationally, but we know him locally as a Republican. In your experience, what was your experience when you were attempting to create these changes within the rank and file, so you had an internal struggle going on there, politically, where were the reinforcements which historically had allied themselves with the labor union movement? Where were they in New York City when you were going through what you were going through?
Well, at the top of things, the state and the city were being led officially by Republican leadership.
Right.
Pataki was the governor, and he was doing exploratory look at running for president in 2008, and I believe that the strike rendered those efforts impossible to continue. If he couldn't control New York City, he could hardly have credentials to run the country. But Bloomberg was the mayor of New York City, and had shifted over to the Republican ticket in order to run. And I think that the record is strong enough with respect to where Bloomberg was. But But in terms of the below that, there was support from Democratic Party elected officials and leaders, and there was support from the labor movement. Not at all the type of support, I think, that is called for when you have a confrontation of that magnitude. When you have a confrontation such as what's going on in Chicago, everyone needs to understand that if there's a loss at that level on such a major national confrontation, it results in concessionary bargaining for decades. It causes setbacks up and down the country from coast to coast. This is what the experience was with the PATCO controller strike in 1981. That as a result of that strike, which Reagan crushed, the labor movement entered the next almost 30 years forced to engage in concessionary bargaining. There was a crushing blow dealt to the idea of standing up, standing together, and fighting back. And the labor, and while the air traffic controllers back then bear some responsibility for how they handled it, it is also true that the organized labor movement bore responsibility for not understanding that this was a call to arms, it was a call to war, and they needed to do a lot more in terms of sending an opposite message about the importance of solidarity and so on. So there were any number of failures. What ended up being, and also in the subsequent to the strike, even being more critical and more impactful, was many of the so-called friends of labor and so-called leftists ended up singing praises to and aligning themselves with the individuals and elements that attempted to undermine the strike right in the middle of the strike, as well as try to help collapse the union after the strike. And what I'm referring to there is that one of the penalties imposed on us after the strike was the removal of our dues. This was the removal, complete removal of dues deductions for members. Now, we were getting $20 million a year in dues. And this order by the courts was an attempt to impose a death sentence on our union. Well, there were many individuals, including the current leadership of the local, that in fact were encouraging people in virtue of various devices to not pay their dues. And many in the left and commentators who present themselves as friends of labor ended up defending the old guard opposition to the strike and defending forces that encourage people to not pay their dues for the long period of time that we went without dues that almost destroyed the union. And so that's a whole other topic of discussion.
What was behind it, you think? What was behind that?
What was behind it was an attempt to... It ended up being a movement of what they call Take Back Our Union, almost like how the Republicans are talking about taking back the country. That's
right.
What was behind it. Very much the same type of tenor and spirit. Mean-spirited backlash from backward forces. That's what's going on in the country. You know, they've been trying to settle scores with the social justice causes that emerged out of the 1960s and early 70s, and they have come to life with programs that they have put in place and been working on for the past couple of decades, and now we are seeing it unfold before around the country.
We are kind of getting close to time, Roger. So I wanted, first of all, whether you know it or not, this is the first of several conversations you'll be having here, so that we could, because I think that the transit strike also requires reexamination, because these two strikes, I believe, in recent history are so instructive from so many perspectives that we really need to understand the significance of these two strikes. And I can't think of a better guide to the backdrop of that than you. So we will be returning to the subject and you many, many more times. But as we round out the program today, if you could give us an overarching view again as to what is it that we need to look for as things unfold tomorrow in Chicago and beyond, based on your direct experience with the transit union strike here in the city of New York.
Well, it's very clear to me from listening to the sister who was on the program before and to Karen Lewis, the leader of the Chicago Teachers Union, that they know what they're doing. And that, and it's clear that they're the subject matter experts in terms of what they're faced with all around the circumstances in Chicago. And I think that we have to rely upon and support their decision with respect to how to resolve or move forward their issues. I think that's real important to not get into second guessing and trying to play what we call, used to call, shithouse lawyer. When you're in the luxury of being on the mountaintop looking down at the battlefield, you shouldn't second guess the generals who leading the troops in the middle of the battlefield down in the valley, is my point. And nothing settled in those battlefields where blows and fire is being traded that doesn't come out with the scars of battle on it. Right? Otherwise, you just engaged in wishful thinking that so many of the irresponsible and folks on the left and intellectuals would like to posture as being the judge and jury of what folks who are doing the actual fighting and doing the battles should or should not be doing. So that, I would caution against that, and I think that there's sufficient clear sense that they have a mature grasp of the situation, and it's real important to rally unwavering support and solidarity around them. And that would be, to my mind, would be the most important takeaway from looking at the situation.
Well, Roger, I want to thank you so much for this introduction today. It's really a class in contemporary labor issues in the United States. Thank you so much. It's a great introduction. I look forward to you coming back and coursing us through not just the current strike in Chicago, but other labor issues as well. So thank you so much for being with us again today.
I certainly appreciate the opportunity, and I will be available.
Thank you. I want to also thank you so much. I see many of you wanting to ask questions, but I thought today it was really important to just get a body of information that we can work with, because I'll be inviting Roger Toussaint right back here to engage with you more fully, but I thought it was an interesting thing to just listen today about how, from the inside and from an expert point of view and from a leadership, this is a top leadership, observing another struggle that so closely mirrored his own, and listen to what he's talking about, that he had to fight within the union. And make no mistake, I'm sure that also holds true for the Chicago Teachers Union. He had to fight the so-called left, people who worked assiduously to undermine the gains of the union. He had to battle with City Hall. And, of course, he had to fight for the rights of workers as well. So it's a very interesting inside view, and it is not normally the case that we have that privileged vantage point. So it was available to us, and I thought we'd take full advantage of it. But we will engage with each other again tomorrow. A really exciting guest will join us tomorrow. She is black and green. So we will be talking to her about that tomorrow. I want to thank you very much. Please do encourage people to tune in at 1 o'clock here and to get to know PRN generally. Tune in at 1 o'clock, be part of this family, and let's grow this conversation. It's too good to just keep it to ourselves. Thank you so much for your warm, warm welcome. If you want to reach me, it's Lead Stories, L-E-I-D, L-E-I-D Stories, at gmail.com. So maybe if you had questions and you couldn't, and comments and couldn't get through, maybe you can do that, and I would certainly keep those in mind when Roger Toussaint, the former president of the Transport Workers Union Local 100, graces us with his presence again sometime soon. All right. And that's it for today. Thank you so much. See you tomorrow. Stand in fact is when you get your foot off my back.